Hi, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we ask poets to select poetry from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then they read one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. Today, my guest is Christian Wyman, the poet, essayist, editor, and translator, whose honors include the 2016 Aiken Taylor Award for Modern American Poetry and the 2020 Lifetime Achievement Award for the Conference on Christianity and Literature. Chris, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Good to see you again, Kevin.
Likewise. So you've chosen to read two short poems from the archive, Far From Kingdoms and Outside, in fact, There Wasn't Any Change, both by Patrizia Cavalli and translated from the Italian by Judith Baumel. What drew you to these particular poems as you were perusing the archive?
Oh, you know, I've long liked Patrizia Cavalli's poems. I mean, I haven't known about them that long, for a decade or so, but she's been very well translated and translated by a lot of different American and English poets. And one of the things that I love about her is that she writes about very intense things with a very deft, light touch. And so her poems can have an almost floating feel to them, and you hardly realize that you've been sort of stabbed as they go by you.
Let's listen to the poems. Here's Christian Wyman reading Far From Kingdoms by Patrizia Cavalli, translated by Judith Baumel.
Far from kingdoms, far from kingdoms, how steady is the room. Come, breathe close with me, so I may discover the sweetness of many imperfections, some missing tooth, some extra wrinkle, and your body worn out slightly by carelessness.
That was Far From Kingdoms by Patrizia Cavalli and translated from the Italian by Judith Baumel, which was published in the October 1st, 1990 issue of the magazine. It was great to hear that, and I love how you read it, because what struck me right away was the pacing in the poem and the way she kind of saves us for that last line surprise. There is a you, I suppose, earlier in the poem, but suddenly this body appears, the missing tooth, you know, and it's almost like she's discussing the missingness, but it's suddenly being assembled in front of us at the end. How did you take the ending of that poem?
I think one of the moving things about it is that we fall in love with all of the ways in which our partners have been wounded. You fall in love with the wounds as well as the strengths. And this is a poem of great care that's celebrating carelessness at the end. And so it's not as if the carelessness has been subsumed entirely. It still exists within this relationship, but it's become part of the love. And I really like the poem for that reason. And I also just like that it's in the melee of our lives and all of the noise of politics and everything that goes around us. We all live for these moments that are small and interior and intense, far from kingdoms, how steady is the room? And she manages to get that. I should say, you know, in the Italian, I think, I don't read Italian, but it's a gendered language, and you would pick up that this is a woman, not a man, and which may or may not be important, but it's interesting to know.
And it's lost in the translation.
Yeah, yeah.
Since we don't have the original in front of us, is there anything else musically that you notice in the poem? Because I also think there's a kind of music the translation captures. You do some translating yourself. Do you think about that when you're reading something like this?
I do. I wonder, like I say, I don't read Italian. I do read Spanish and can get by in Italian, but I can at least puzzle out the sounds and get a sense of what the poem sounds like. And here I think there's a discrepancy between the booming beginning, far from kingdoms, how steady is the room, and then the rest of the poem becomes quite quiet. And she even has an exclamation point after that, those first two lines.
Yeah. Well, that's there here, which I love. And there's this kind of, I mean, in English at least, there's this kind of rhyme, consonants, kingdoms, room, and then sweetness and carelessness, which I'm sure the translator has thought of. But I'm struck also by the breaks and your body break worn out slightly, which, you know, adverbs are like, you don't usually use them that much. And then here it's like the poem would be so different if it didn't have that slightly. It just It's so wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I had not noticed that at all. And also that some missing, and then tooth is on the next line where you don't know what's missing until you get there.
Right. And a tooth is so different. And they're talking about imperfections, the sweetness of many imperfections, which is true. And I think you put it so well in the start. This poem is about the beloved in some sense and how the beloved is always perfect in their imperfections.
Yeah. Yeah. Love manages to subsume those.
And why do you think the kingdom's there? I mean, I have my own guess, but I'm curious about yours.
Well, that was my guess, is that that this happens, this moment of domestic intimacy happens far from kingdoms and also despite kingdoms, despite the fact that kingdoms are in fact always encroaching upon us. What's your guess? Is it different than that?
Well, I think this question of power and distance, the farness that you're talking about, I think is really interesting, or that the poet is talking about, I should say. How far are we talking? I always love that in a poem, you know, when Pound's version of The River Merchant's Wife, a letter where she says, "I will come to meet you as far as Chofu Sa." And I always ask my students, do you think that's far, or do you think that's kind of like halfway or just a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. How far is that, you know? And I think there's here that distance, it feels enormous, you know, and but you feel like it's someone within that kingdom,
yeah.
But far from it, if that makes sense. Like you said, despite kingdoms.
Yeah, that's the way I read it. And that's probably a good way to move into the next one, which also I think plays on that literal figurative line.
Absolutely. Let's hear it. So the other poem is called Outside. In fact, there wasn't any change. So let's hear Christian Wyman reading Outside. In fact, there wasn't any change by Patrizia Cavalli, translated by Judith Baumel.
Outside, in fact, there wasn't any change. Outside, in fact, there wasn't any change. The ripened disease is what removes me from the streets. It has grown inside me and corrupted my eyes and all my other senses, and the world arrives like a quotation. Everything has happened by now, but me, where was I? When did the great diversion come? Where did the string become untied? Where did the fissure open up? Which is the lake that lost its waters? And, changing the landscape, scrambles my way.
That was Outside, in fact, there wasn't any change by Patrizia Cavalli and translated from the Italian by Judith Baumel, which was published in the January 21st, 1991 issue of The New Yorker. So you said that our talk of distance brought you here, thinking about this poem. Tell me what makes you think about this in terms of place or distance.
Well, distance between the person and reality in this poem, and also the line between the literal and the figurative. I can't quite tell when I first start reading this poem whether the disease, the ripened disease, is literal or figurative. Ripened suggests it's literal, but the rest of the poem suggests it's figurative. And I don't know. The poem seems to allow a literal reading, but to suggest a figurative one, partly because of the tenses change. Mm-hmm. Outside, in fact, there wasn't any change. But then in the next line, the ripened disease is what removes me from the streets. So it becomes present tense. And then in the second stanza, everything has happened by now.
Right.
Tenses keep shifting in this poem. And I find it a powerful expression of a kind of disease of despair that can come upon you, and you don't know when it started, you don't know where it came from, you don't know when the string became untied or the fissure opened up or which is the lake. Apparently there are a lot of lakes there, but which is the lake that lost its waters, and now everything is scrambled and you can't get through it and can't get back to reality. And the world arrives like a quotation, which is a great phrase.
Oh, man, that's an incredible line.
Yeah, where everything seems to come to you in quotes, as if it's not quite real and has a tinged with irony and has this distance to it.
Well, and that it belongs to someone else in a weird way, like that it isn't felt or experienced, but it's spoken of. As you say, it doesn't feel like you can quite reach it, but it also feels used up somehow already. It has grown inside me and corrupted my eyes.
Yeah, secondhand. Everything becomes secondhand.
Sure. I wonder, too, you know, just hearing it now aloud, as we've been still 2 years later dealing with the pandemic in different ways, you know, if we take it for a moment to be literal or think of that kind of removal from the streets that's happened to many of us, I think that's really a powerful moment because it also has this other accompanying feeling or set of feelings that I don't think we've sorted out yet, even if we all return to work tomorrow. So here we are. What scrambled the way? I mean, it's a different feeling, but it's curious to me what you're talking about, the literal, which I think is also accompanied by the metaphoric, maybe.
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful way to think about this poem and evidence of how a poem can really shift, doesn't necessarily change it, but shift its meaning depending on the context. I mean, Kay Ryan has a famous example in The New Yorker about the chickens coming home to roost, and that was accepted before 9/11, but then it ran after 9/11, and of course it had a completely different meaning, different inflection to the poem. And I know she was ambivalent about that.
Right. Well, how do you feel about a kind of poem like this, which I think is purposely thinking about ambiguity, but also able to kind of talk about philosophy, but the lake? I mean, it's a thing I admire in your work too, that we're going to hear in a minute. But how did you, you know, do you think it shifts on you, or is that a tonal thing that you're drawn to as well?
Absolutely. I think it's more powerful given the reading that you gave it, that it seems to me a poem becomes more powerful if it can speak into these different circumstances in which it wasn't written, despite whatever misgivings a poet might have. But I think the powerful thing about this poem as it relates to now is sort of exactly what you were saying, that the pandemic has existed literally and figuratively at the same time, and we can't disentangle the two, and we're suffering from both. And and so it's very difficult to even figure out, when did this start? How did this start? You know, is this something that was even happening before the pandemic? I know in my own life, there's a kind of depression or despair that the pandemic has brought about, and you can't get your hands around it. You know, you can't figure out exactly how to reckon with it.
I mean, there's other kinds of reckoning that I think have accompanied it. And I keep returning to those lines and that beginning, which is so a matter of fact, and in English has a kind of almost non-poetic quality, you know, outside, in fact, you know, it's almost like a dispatch or something. But then that ripened disease, as you put it, is so powerful. And it is that real mix of, and I think sometimes the feelings you're describing have that mix of something deeply felt and then something kind of clinical almost. The ripened disease is what removes me feels very different. Or the great diversion, you know, which isn't quite the same as a great depression or the great resignation, but somehow there's this kind of talking to those ideas.
Yeah, those are great observations, I think. I really like that distinction between those first two lines where it is repertorial and then suddenly very visceral, and those two things just jam together.
Well, and I love that the lake, we're hearing it rather than seeing it. But if you turn to the magazine, you can hear even that pacing, which is the lake that lost its waters and changing the landscape. You know, it's almost happening in front of us. And I love how a poem enacts the processes it describes, and rather it doesn't even describe, it enacts it. And so here we are, changing the landscape scrambles my way. The my is sort of delayed there. This lake is expanding and changing. And then the way is scrambled, which is such a great verb there.
Yeah, that's a great perception. And it's weird. I'm reminded again for the millionth time of how having despair or depression articulated or given form can be a great consolation to it. Even though this offers no consolation literally, right. But
right.
But having it in form is consoling.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it's only funny because it's true. You know, you put it so well. I mean, you know, I'm a fan of the blues and come from that tradition in many ways. And to me, part of the blues's power is naming pain, you know, and I think it names it in order to get past it. But it also here is naming it to kind of say that it isn't a small thing. It's the fissure. It's the string, you know, it isn't this moment that shouldn't be unremarked upon. And it's a different kind of testimony. And I think a very personal one. I don't know. I think the temptation can be to make it bigger. And this manages to do both. I don't know. Somehow it's both personal and mythic at the same time for me.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, the temptation can be to be self-dramatizing. And this, what I respond to in this poem is it's not at all that.
Yeah. I wonder about the plain spokenness of it. And does that come across in the original? I wonder. And I'm always fascinated by tone and how you translate that. Is that something you think about? You know, do you feel like you're making choices in translating between tone and sound and meaning, and or all those the same thing for you as a translator?
Oh, I've done so little translating. I did one book, and then I've done scattered translations here and there that I don't feel like I...
That's one more than me. I just want to... And then many of our listeners, too. So you have done a lot.
But yes, I think you do take all those things into account and think about it. One of the really interesting things about the way that Patrizia Cavalli has been translated, and in particular, the selected poems that came out a few years ago that had all those different American translators in it and some English, is that she doesn't really seem like one poet in that book. She seems like a lot of different poets. Sometimes you can sort of feel it going far afield and you think, I don't know about that. I don't know how close that can be to this other poet. And that's something I think that they did deliberately. They wanted to filter it through all these different American voices and see what survived or what it amounted to. She said, I read an interview with her where she said that what she felt like when she was reading it was like she was getting to know all of these other poets individually, but maybe not herself so much.
That's wonderful. Now, in our May 14th, 2018 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, Eating Grapes Downward, which you'll read for us in a moment. But first, is there anything you'd like to say about the poem or that you think listeners should know?
Maybe I should say it uses two Japanese words, karategi and kiai. The first is what you wear when doing karate, and kiai is the sound that one makes. And it mentions Samuel Butler. You don't need to know this, but he was a 19th century novelist and critic, now pretty well forgotten, although not completely, but, you know, obscure. And I think that's all.
Let's hear it. Here's Christian Wyman reading his poem, Eating Grapes Downward.
Eating Grapes Downward. Every morning, without thinking, I open my notebook and see if something might have grown in me during the night. Usually, no. But sometimes a tendril tries a crack in my consciousness, and if I remain only indirectly aware of it and tether my attention to the imminent and perhaps ultimately unseeable sun, sometimes it will grow. Inevitably, a sense of insignificance intrudes. I think of all the lives in all the places waiting in their ways for something to grow out of them, into them. Is it the same God? I have a cousin whose political opinions vile up out of him on the internet in the most imaginative ways. He sports a cartoon mustache like Raleigh Fingers that was a lodestone of enduring awe in my childhood, along with his gift for scissoring bricks with one blow. With his spanking karategi and cowboy kiai, his weasel sleek of hair and handlebars, he was a spectacle there in Midland, Texas, circa 1973, where the sun slammed the blacktop and the pump jacks beaked the background like prehistoric crows. Always eat grapes downward, advises Samuel Butler, a corroded copy of whose notebooks I perused at the backwoods Woodbridge bookstore that seemed somehow already erstwhile. While my daughters fussed and bleated to be outside with the miniature cow Mona, so named because her moo was like a moan. Savor the best grapes first, Butler means, so there will be none better on the bunch, and each will seem delicious to the last. In truth, I don't quite follow the logic, though his conclusion, past 50, everyone eats their days downward, is unassailable. What else? That people who can whistle their speech. My terminal confusion of preterite and predicate. The meanings we live but cannot have. Oh, and Mona, who seemed less cow than concept, really. Half animal, half irony. Sticking her rubbable muzzle through the fence like a Labrador. We stayed a long while petting the impossibility of her. We gave her, if you can believe it, grapes left over from our lunch. And when they were gone, and we were almost, her moo blewed the air like a sorrow so absurd it left nothing left of us but laughter.
I was eating Grapes Downward by Christian Wyman.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Well, I love Mona in this poem. What a gift / invention, however it came, but it has that great quality. It leads to some of my favorite sounds in the poem, miniature cow Mona, so named because her moo was like a moan, but also that cow concept, half animal, half irony line, which is so wonderful, and her rubbable muzzle. Those sounds, I think, are so rich. And then the poem is also a little how we were talking about Cavalli's work, able to kind of talk about these mix of feelings, some delicious to the last and some the meanings we live but cannot have. How did that come about for you in the poem? I mean, it takes in a lot, you know, this almost journey it takes. Does it come from a kind of literal sense of a journey, or is it just working out these ideas that must have been fun to stumble across Butler's strange quote?
Yeah, that was what triggered the poem, that quote. And I did buy that book and I brought it home and, you know, lived with it for a while. It was not very interesting, the book, but I read around in it. But that struck me, that phrase struck me, and the paragraph about it, which doesn't make any sense to me. And then the rest of the poem, in all honesty, it all just fell out of me.
Yeah.
And I was, well, you know how this goes. You follow the sounds.
Sure.
The sounds are leading you on. And in all honesty, I wrote it and sort of never looked back at it. And until we got ready to do this podcast and I began looking at it much more closely, reading my own poem, I began making discoveries and seeing things that I really hadn't seen because I follow the sounds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, people might not know, we've known each other a long time. I think it's going on 30 years. We were in the same class a long time ago at the Stegner, and that was so wonderful. And you were always a sound man then, I must say. You always had that quality. I think there's also something here about I wouldn't have said this before, and reading it again, it feels almost like a kind of Ars Poetica, because it takes in some of these questions of notebooks and writing and seeing if something's grown in you. And then that question, which I think does course through some of your other poems, is it the same God? You know, you kind of go past it, but, you know, then you have Mona almost as this kind of, I don't know, is she a stand-in? Is she like a visiting being, you know, whatever she is that urges you on? So tell me about that. Like, did you recognize in reading it again, which, you know, I'm sure some of our listeners might not know that sometimes poems fall out of you in the way you're talking about, and that you're discovering a little, like you said, Cavalli did, looking at the poet who wrote this almost as a stranger. How did that feel? Do you see those themes in some of your other work here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you have certain obsessions in your work. And, you know, I tend not to trust writers who don't have obsessions, who you can't find a single obsession all the way through. But so I am obsessed with God. I'm obsessed with the tears of things, lacrimae rerum, and because I feel them. I feel that in the world. And so this is a poem about sorrow, I think, ultimately, and about how we have any communication with God and what part creation, our own creation, has to do with that. So yeah, I was not at all conscious that I was treating these grave subjects as I was writing the poem. I was thinking about this whimsical cow who is real, not outside that bookshop, but actually there was a cow, that a miniature cow that we me and my daughters fed at another place down in Texas.
Sure.
And I was just playing with the sounds and floating over all this. And I do think laughter, you know, it ends in laughter. And I think laughter can have a kind of metaphysical significance. Well, there's a sociologist, philosopher, Peter Berger, who says, during the moment of comedy, the tragedy of man is bracketed. And religion vindicates the comic and reinterprets the meaning of laughter, something like that. And so I think a moment of laughter in a work, in a poem, or in another work of literature, what have you, can be not simply a moment of like comic relief, though it can be that,
sure.
But it can also be a kind of the same metaphysical significance of sorrow or these other things that we're talking about.
Well, and the poem has a humor, I think, if only in its ability to kind of not be so sure about itself, while it's also kind of assured. I'm thinking about lines like, and each will seem delicious to the last. In truth, I don't quite follow the logic, you know. There's that kind of tone, a rhetorical tone that comes up, and then you get to pack in Raleigh Fingers and Samuel Butler in the same poem. That's pretty good, you know. You're making use of the full range of the experience of what it is to be right now. And that idea that you talk about that seems somehow already erstwhile, while my daughters fussed and bleated to be outside. You know, there's a real interesting sense of language there, but also of what's lost. There's a kind of bittersweetness in the poem that isn't simply just sorrow, at least to me. At least it makes out of it a cartoon mustache. It makes laughter out of these observations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should have included Raleigh Fingers in my introduction, because he was a famous reliever way back when. I mean, if you're not a certain age, you want to.
Everybody knows who Raleigh Fingers
exactly,
is. Let's face it.
But he was famous for his handlebar, this waxed handlebar mustache. And he was also like one of the first, he may have been the first pitcher to become famous as a reliever. They're everywhere now, but back then they weren't thought of as that. And he grew.
He
that
had
thing.
That great name. I mean, his
I
name alone, and even Butler. You get some double triple meanings there.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess what I admire about it, the first line, which seems like some of the openness that the poem seems open to, like every morning without thinking, I open. I love that idea. And somehow it has a kind of feeling of a mind at work and wandering a bit. But in the end, it's very controlled and tight. Is that something you're conscious of?
Now that you say it, and now that the poem exists, certainly. I mean, I can see that the aim was in a way to sort of have the experience of, you know, opening your notebook and this thing falls into place and everything. And it wasn't quite that easy. but also the, you know, I do think that you're onto something by saying it's a kind of ars poetica, like my statement of poetry or what poetry can mean to me, particularly the meanings we live but do not have. That line that comes near the end of the poem, because if I have a sense of the poem, it's that, because I would be hard pressed to say what the meaning of this poem is, except for that. There seems to be meaning everywhere in it, very important to me in my life, and I have it. But ask me what it is, I'm not quite sure. So.
Right. Well, and I love the grapes in that way. And to be honest, I think a lesser poet would have ended with the conclusion, everyone hates their days downward, is unassailable. I mean, that in a way is a philosophy. You've hit it. And then you say, what else? Like, you let the speaker, you let yourself say, what else is there? And I think that's an important moment. And, you know, sometimes I see that we stop ourselves, if we're writers, from doing that. You know, from asking that question. Instead, we're like, this is a really good ending. And here I feel like, you know, that extra stanza with that petting the impossibility of her, which I think is very another way of saying living it and not having it. Like, there's this impossible thing, yet it's right there. And it's touchable. I think that's really part of what the poem is about. And that what else gets you to. It gets us back to Mona and that kind of notebook feeling, but also about that lush ending. It feels very lush to me, even though it's blued the air like a sorrow so absurd. And wringing lushness out of that seems one of the points.
Yeah, and you have to believe it. We gave her, if you can believe it, grapes. So that in some way that I think it's about, I mean, one of the things I was noticing is that one of my other obsessions is a link between aesthetic experience, particularly poetry for me, but aesthetic experience and religious experience and the way one can mirror the other and demand the other. And so I think the line there, if you can believe it, near the end, clearly echoes back to the God that was brought up in the first stanza. Again, I'm using it colloquially here. It's like, if you can believe it, seems so preposterous, but.
Right. Well, are they, butler's grapes, or are they like the grape? Are they the body? I mean, what are they meant to be for the poet there?
Literal grapes, man.
Concord. We want to know. Seedless. Like, we want to know the specific. No, I think there's something in that I think is really great. Again, I remember, I don't know when it was, probably when I was working on poems about my dad, I was like, I want to write poems that happened, but then wring from them metaphor. If you know, like the metaphor was part of the experience, and somehow it felt really important for me in those moments to make meaning out of it.
Yeah.
And there's something in that, in the end of the poem, it feels like.
Yeah, that's very provocative for me, because it's not like you're foisting metaphor onto it, or that it existed for you. It did exist for you there at the time, but completely unconsciously, it was part of it. It's Seamus Heaney is the one who's so good at that.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I agree. And I think that's the thing that I'm sure he gave me permission in a way, having studied with him years ago, but also just hearing him read and reading him over the years. The other thing I think he teaches us is that you can return to those experiences. Like, those are yours, you know, like you don't have a choice in a way. You know, when he writes about his brother passing, I mean, it's so powerful. And, you know, someone else would be like, I wrote that one elegy. Of course, us who end up having to write elegies, no, you just keep doing it. And you're trying to get at that thing, because it isn't about, you know, or maybe it is about those meanings we live but cannot have.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not capturing the experience, because you don't do that exactly. It's somehow honoring the reality of them, keeping them real in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a powerful way of thinking about how poems kind of accompany us and also change. And it goes back to, for me, again, the way that this poem feels like it talks about lots of aspects of your writing, including, I would say, text is right there. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wonder how do you wrestle with that in others of your work? You know, is place always there for you?
Texas is like the place I can't escape. And I left there when I was 18, 17, actually. And it's like the place in my mind that I cannot escape. And it exerts such gravitational force on me. The landscape, the people, I mean, the tough people who sometimes just seem like instances of the landscape somehow, like they're parts of it, including this guy, this cousin who's quite real. He still seems to me like Texas embodied.
Well, in that spectacle where the sun slammed the blacktop and the pump jacks beaked the background like prehistoric crows. I mean, Heaney definitely made his appearance there. I mean, you have to be chewing up the landscape there and have that sound that Heaney, I think, helps us hear.
Yeah, that definitely owes something to Heaney, I'm sure. I mean, I've read him so hard over the years, as you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think of Texas as a hard place. I mean, those hard sounds and those lines are my experience of Texas and quite different from the ending.
Right.
Yeah, different where it becomes vowel sounds. Her moo blued the air.
Well, and again, there's the blues, Texas blues right there.
Exactly. I thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. Will you tell us sort of what you're up to now and what you're thinking about? Are you writing something new or...
I've just put together a book, which is called Zero at the Bone, 50 Entries Against Despair, since we were talking about despair, and it's made up of all kinds of things. I say this in the brief little intro of the book, that I've published all these different kinds of books, and they come out discreetly, but I just don't experience them that way. They seem to me to all bleed together, and I don't experience genre that way. That all seems to me to bleed together as well. And so I wanted to see if I could write one book that simply put it all in there and see what happens. So that's what it is. A mixture of all the different kinds of writing I've done, including editing. There's even five sections that are edited, purely edited bits of other people's writing.
Well, I love that. I mean, I feel this much the same way. I mean, I definitely sometimes deciding to write nonfiction or an essay or something like that. But I've come to understand that's almost a poet's approach to it. Poets feel pretty comfortable or sometimes, I need a sonnet right now and I need this, it doesn't seem so far away to us perhaps. Well, this is so wonderful. Thank you so much, Chris.
Great to be with you, Kevin. Thank you.
Eating Grapes Downward by Christian Wyman, as well as Judith Baumel's translations of Patrizia Cavalli's Far From Kingdoms, and Outside, In Fact, There Wasn't Any Change, can be found on newyorker.com. Judith Baumel's translations of Patrizia Cavalli's poems appear in the book My Poems Will Not Change the World. Christian Wyman's latest collection is Survival is a Style.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and The New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Hannah Eisenman.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.